So that takes us back to the interpretation of the middle way in relation to ethics. So I want to argue that the middle way has a moral purpose, and again that's central to the way it is in Buddhism, in traditional Buddhism, because there is this association of avoiding metaphysics with being more morally justified in traditional Buddhism. And you get that in the avoidance of asceticism and self-indulgence in the traditional Buddhist model. But if we put this into a more modern or a more universal kind of context, then I think firstly, I've already talked a bit about the idea of objectivity and the idea of addressing conditions. Yeah, so I would suggest that that's the central moral imperative. That's what I'd see ethics as being about. Ultimately speaking, it's about objectivity or about addressing conditions. So rather than obeying a set of rules or even principles which come from a tradition or from God or anything like that, or on the other hand, rather than completely denying any such principles, there is getting what we can out of such principles, or seeing what they have to tell us in terms of how they help us engage conditions, but not accepting the kind of absolute truth claims which go with them. So the middle way, I think, is a way, guides us towards moral objectivity, but it's not a justification for relativism. So it can't lead us, or it doesn't justify us in coming to the conclusion that any moral view is as good as any other moral view. We may not know which moral views are better than other moral views. There's a lot of uncertainty. It doesn't justify us in moral triumphalism. We know the truth, etc. Mm-hmm. But we can still have the confidence that it's possible to gain views which are better than other views. So it's possible to make progression, mm-hmm. morally speaking. And we do that by accepting the uncertainty of that situation rather than grabbing onto a moral certainty and saying, well, this is the way we do it, this is how we get to be good. And one of the problems with relativism is it takes us back to one of two things. It's either social convention or individual preference, which relativists tend to appeal to either explicitly or implicitly as the basis of ethics. So if you don't have a belief in some sort of absolute source of ethics, then the usual other pole, the usual other way of thinking about it, the opposite way of thinking about it, is to say, well, that the rules of your society, effectively, or the conventions of your society, are what you ought to do, how you ought to behave. Or choose yourself. And that's the kind of existentialist take, your choice is the what creates ethics, that kind of the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre. But those would all be included in what I would call moral relativism, which I don't think helps us. It's just as much of a distraction or potential source of delusion as these absolute beliefs on the other side. So if the middle way is the source of moral objectivity, this also implies another radical thing which challenges a lot of assumptions in Western thinking, which is particularly to do with the distinction between scientific and moral forms of objectivity. So my argument is that there's one form of objectivity. There is objectivity which people can develop. And obviously each individual in their conditions, in their circumstances, will develop objectivity in their own way. But there isn't a distinct scientific objectivity that people will develop separately from their moral objectivity, or indeed another kind of objectivity is aesthetic objectivity. You know, what makes a great musician or whatever, what makes their judgments correct. I would argue there is the same objectivity, but there are obviously different ways in which it's applied and different circumstances in which it's applied. Now, that argument opens up a lot of different issues which we'll need to discuss. But that again seems to me to be an implication of where the middle way is taking us. If we're really going to take seriously this linkage between psychological states and beliefs, and the idea that the middle way is taking us forward somewhere, that it's helping us progress, and that has moral implications, you know, that progression can't just be seen in this sort of dry, abstract way as purely factual, nor on the other hand can it be seen as purely moral. And I think that perspective is backed up by other things which I'm going to talk about this week, which are to do with neuroscientific evidence about meaning, about the brain, which I think can be interpreted in ways which support that. But okay, and just another linkage we could make with the middle way in relation to ethics, well, in a very broad sense, is the idea of homeostasis, which I believe, am I pronouncing that correctly?
I tend to say homeostasis.
Homeostasis.
I don't think there's a
you probably
know correct way of saying it.
Yeah. Homeostasis then. Homeostasis is the way I understand biologists talk about a sort of balanced way of operating of an organism, which allows them to adapt to their conditions in the best way possible. So, for example, if you've got a simple organism, and it could even be an amoeba or something like that, which it could overreact to its circumstances. So every time it gets a very slight stimulus, which might be food, it might shoot out its pseudopodium or whatever and try and get it, but then it will expend too much energy too quickly because it will fail too often. Or it might not be reactive enough and not get enough food, and then it'll starve. There's a balance, a basic balance it needs to reach in the way it reacts to its environment. And what determines how it does that? Well, basically some sort of neural map. Maybe you don't have neural maps, but they have some sort of genetic coding which determines, or perhaps specific epigenetic effects on that coding, which enable them to respond in a certain way to their environment. And they need flexibility to respond to changes in their environment and maintain that homeostasis, so that's a really flexible balance which responds to those circumstances. So I would suggest that the middle way can be understood as continuous with that idea. Obviously, it's not just about adaptation to our environment in the evolutionary sense, but there's a connection with that. It can be a one way into thinking about the middle way.
Mm. Coming back to the points about relativism, I think that the our sort of modern understanding of evolutionary theory is extremely helpful in providing evidence to justify that that perspective, because particularly with the moral stuff, I think that there may be positions somewhere between complete relativism and absolute sort of deontological claims. We were talking about Jonathan Haidt's work the other day. It was very descriptive and just saying, well, this is the way that human beings are in terms of how they practically organise their societies and their common themes. And these themes don't seem to be arbitrary. They crop up time and time again in different societies that are separated, which suggests that there's something much more fundamental than an individual's opinion or choice. It's that individuals' opinions and choices have been driven by something other than arbitrary preference. Mm.
like those trolley arguments, aren't they? And the fat man on the train. I don't know if you're familiar. There are these ethical thought experiments where in the first situation with a runaway train, 80% of people will take a utilitarian position on it. But then in the second scenario, where you have to push a
fat... where the guy's lying on the track and you have to...
Well, in the first one, you're the driver of a train, brakes don't work, and there are five people on the track ahead of you.
Ah.
And they're wearing headphones and they've got pneumatic drills, so they don't know the train's coming. But you do have steerage. And if you go off to the left, there's one person on the track with headphones. And yeah. And in that situation, when you question people, most people, 80% of people, say they would turn the wheel. And they've done this also with people hunter-gathering communities in New Guinea, and they're in their boats and there's crocodiles and stuff. See that, and it pans out across, as you were saying, Julian. But then the second scenario is that you are on a bridge looking over the situation, and there's a train coming, there's no driver, and but again there's five people on the track, and there's a big fat man stood next to you leaning over, and all he needs is a little nudge.
Mm.
And then in that situation, although it has lots of similarities with the first one, the greatest happiness of the greatest number, potentially in a utilitarian formula, 80% of people won't push that person over. And Jonathan Haidt suggests, a bit like Chomsky suggests, that we are that there is some neural stuff going on in terms of language, that there's something that we are predisposed to language, but also in our neurobiology, there's something there to enable to think in the first sense in a utilitarian way, in the second sense in a deontological way. I don't know what you make of that.
Well, it's quite interesting. I hadn't heard those figures. I don't think that is quite a good indicator of people's judgment, isn't it?
Mm.
That they can think differently in those two different sorts of situations.
But what for me is fascinating is that from whatever cultural background, you get these very similar figures.
But I think it's important not to assume that means that we can just do a descriptive analysis of the situation and converge on the right answer.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
And I suppose where I find evolutionary theory quite kind of supporting of this middle way approach is that if you take the example of an amoeba, for example, it has preferences. It will move up and down a concentration gradient to find a situation that suits it, you know, optimally.
Mm.
And so its preferences are governed or influenced by its biology. And what I'd argue is that as human beings, we're not fundamentally different from an amoeba. It's just that our biology is vastly more complex and our preferences are vastly more numerous. But nonetheless, there are a kind of finite number of viable solutions. And that's where morality is not entirely relativistic. There might be a number of different solutions to a moral problem, but they are finite. And they're potentially finite, and the number of solutions is kind of governed by our biology and situations and conditions and contingencies.
But also within those possible responses, surely it's not just a question of counting how many possible responses, or are there gradations of response that are more and less effective responses.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
And I quite like Sam Harris's metaphor, I haven't read his book, but I like the metaphor of the moral landscape, the idea that there can be peaks on this moral landscape. I don't quite, I'm from what I've heard of what Sam's been saying around this, I wonder whether he takes his claims a little bit too far and actually falls into a kind of metaphysical position with it. But the metaphor itself, I like the idea that we live in a moral landscape and we can find different peaks within it. It's not necessarily that one peak is the right one. There is a degree of possible choice, as it were.
I'm not quite with what this
moral landscape is. So, I suppose if you think about, you know, the way you can have a two-dimensional graph with a y-axis and x-axis with two variables, and you can define a point on that, in that space, if you like.
Yeah.
And you can add an extra axis, which will make it three-dimensional, and then you can define surfaces rather than lines. And in the same way as you've got on a one-dimensional graph, you might have a plot of sort of yield versus expenditure or something, and it will go in a curve, and the peak at the top is the optimum expenditure for yield ratio, and that's what you're aiming for in terms of maximum profitability or whatever. And then you add an extra dimension, an extra variable, and you end up with a three-dimensional landscape. And you can mathematically, in theory, add as many dimensions as you want and get multi-dimensional space, which, okay, we can't visualize, but you can imagine it works in the same way. You can find a peak in the space and say, oh yeah, that peak is where we want to aim for. But in the same way as a line can have multiple peaks, a landscape can have multiple peaks, where all these different variables are, or conditions, if you like, are satisfied more completely, or to the greatest extent, as you can find an optimum place in that landscape. And I suppose to think about it in moral terms, it's often said that the problem or the enterprise of ethics is balancing one demand against another. So you know, you've got principles like justice and sort of beneficence, doing good, you know, helping people, doing good things, avoiding bad things. You've got these different kind of competing principles, and so to take a classic situation in healthcare, little Jimmy doesn't want to get his bandage changed, and you as a nurse know that he needs to have his bandage changed, but in order to force Jimmy to get his bandage changed, you're helping him, you're being beneficent, but you're also overruling his autonomy, which is another moral principle. And so you've got immediately got this conflict. So finding the peaks on the moral landscape is finding where you can get maximum amount of autonomy, maximum amount of justice, maximum amount of beneficence, maximum amounts of non-malevolence, whatever.
Right. That very much ties in with the middle way, that sort of... what I like, another aspect I like about the middle way, I don't know if you've come across this, but this idea with ethics, that you say, you know, you've got these three very prominent systems in Western ethics. You've got utilitarianism, deontology, and virtue ethics. And you make the point that rather than taking that this is the ultimate way to view ethics, well, you think of the situation. Well, this situation, a consequentialist way of thinking about that might help, or that you use all of them as rules of thumb. And like tools in a toolkit almost, and I find that very helpful. Sometimes I think actual virtue ethics was on the way towards that anyway, in a little bit. You know, say for example, if a classic moral dilemma, like a friend of yours comes to you with a horrible haircut, and then. You have to think, am I going to be kind here or am I going to be honest? And if they haven't smiled for 6 months, then you're going to veer towards more being kind, aren't you? Whereas if they're going out on a hot date that evening, and so I think that's but yeah, I mean, so it's thinking about what the situation requires. Virtue ethics seems to be the ethical code that is most similar to me to Buddhist ethics, but if you take it to its extreme, what where do you think you can go wrong with virtue ethics?
Well, virtue ethics is about getting better habits, really.
Yeah.
So training yourself in the long term to be a better person, to be virtuous. But if you put all the emphasis on the longer term, then you may neglect the immediate issues.
Of course,
And also, training yourself in that way doesn't directly help you with immediate judgments or help you to decide. You know, if you're standing on the bridge with the fat man and whatever, then doesn't help you at that point to think, well, what would be the virtuous thing to do here?
Yeah.
That just repeats the question, really.
Yeah. But then also that's the argument against, often the argument against virtue ethics, like, because you could define virtue ethics as a virtuous action is what a virtuous person does.
Yeah.
But it's a bit circular in a sense, because then, well, how do you know what a virtuous person is?
Yeah.
But then a virtuous person knows what the right thing is to do, does the right thing, and does the right thing for the right reason. But they're able to be virtuous through this process of habituation and reflection and training.
Yeah. But I mean, there are various issues with it in that philosophers like Aristotle, who gave us a lot of stuff about virtue ethics, tend to define it in terms of their society and what was virtuous in their society.
Yeah.
So I think one needs a universal principle with which to interpret it, and one also needs a practical guide to judgment of some kind.
Mm.
But this is something we'll come back to, because we're going to have a session on ethics.
On ethics, yeah.